accession number 32297, reel 21.
John Dixon, reel 21.
Right, so we're back from Taormina. We've had our leave there, and we're all looking like natives by them beautiful suntans we had. And then the next momentous thing to happen, I suppose it's possible it could have happened before we went to Taormina, but it doesn't matter from the point of view of this story. It was suddenly D-Day. No, sorry, I do apologise. Not D-Day at all. It was VE Day. VE Day, the 8th of May 1945, was it not? So the war in Europe was over. It didn't mean all that much to us because we knew that our war wasn't over. There was still the war was going on out in the Pacific and in the East Indies. Although nobody ever told you these things, but you know, a fleet like ours wasn't going to just suddenly cease to exist because the war in Europe ended. We knew we were going further east. So although there were celebrations, yes, and I mean everybody was given a couple of days leave, I remember we went sailing, but the biggest memory of all to me on VE Day was the church bells. They were ringing all over the island, and every church seemed to have a different peal of bells, and it was just a magical sort of feeling that everybody was in a festive mood. And well, when you think what the Maltese people had been through, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier, you can understand that the celebrations were heartfelt, and we were quite glad to be part of it. Our ship was anchored in Grand Harbour, and they lit it up. Normally you didn't have the ship lit up at all, but all the edge of the decks were all lit up with fairy lights. They put two searchlights on that formed a V, and we've got pictures of it, of the ship with the big V searchlights going up. But that was VE Day. There we are. So that was an end of one period of the war. The Germans were finished.
And you'd more or less anticipated, I take it, at that stage that you were heading to the Far East
anyway? Oh, I think we knew that, yes. I mean, there may have been one or two people, but hardly anybody, that were high up the demob list. If you were RMVR, you knew that you would be demobbed in your own turn, and you had a sort of rating depending on your length of service and your age and marital status and that sort of thing. I don't think we lost anybody that was immediately sent home. The only person we did lose was a chap called Charlie Wintringham, who was a New Zealander. And they had a situation where if they were outside New Zealand for 3 years or more, they had to go home for 3 months' leave. There was no question about it. Charlie didn't want to go, but he asked Cedric Garcia, could he not stay with the squadron? But it would have been a diplomatic incident if he hadn't gone home. So he went home. And in fact, his 3 months' leave didn't start until he actually set foot in New Zealand, and then 3 months after that he was due to come back, and he was just on his way back to join us, by which time we were out in Australia or somewhere, when VJ Day came, so he never did rejoin us. But that was Charlie. Now the other sad thing, and I've forgotten to tell you this, It was a desperate day. I think it was the 6th of April 1945. We'd been flying in the morning. I don't know what the exercise was, but one of our ship's corsairs of 1850 Squadron, a chap called Sub-Lieutenant Bardner was the pilot, I didn't see this, but he called up in distress because he'd got an engine fire, he'd got plenty of height. So whether he was told or whether he had made up his own mind, he jumped out. Probably the safest thing to do. Now, it was Gordon Wallace, one of our top observers, as I've mentioned. He was flying nearby, and he actually saw this. And he saw Bardner jump out, and he saw the parachute open, and he saw it deploy properly, and so it was just a question of fishing him out of the sea. It was a perfectly calm day. There was no problem at all, as far as anybody knew. Gordon Wallace, it marked the spot completely with on his map chart, and sent the signal back, and the Air Sea Rescue Services went straight to the spot where they were told. They never found him. They didn't find any sign of him at all. Nothing at all. That's the rest of our Barracuda squadron, we were immediately organised to fly off and do a search. We all flew slightly different areas. We searched all day. Nothing. Couldn't find a thing. We landed, had a quick supper, and we were asked to volunteer to go out again that evening at night to search again, on the basis that he should have been in his own dinghy, and he would have little signal flares in the dinghy, and he would let you know where he was. So I think, well, I'm certain that everybody that was available volunteered to go. I went with my crew. Jack Birch went with his crew, and we took off, not exactly side by side, but we were together, and he was going to fly a slightly different route to me to get to this search area. Sad to say, we didn't see anything. We carried out our search, nothing at all. Nothing was ever heard of Jack Birch and his crew again. They just disappeared. There was no call of an emergency, nothing at all. And to this day, I don't think anybody could ever tell you what happened to them. So it was Jack Birch, Dave Robbins was his observer, and a chap called Hamill, Petty Officer Hamill, was the air gunner. Gone. And the Barracuda just disappeared. So that was a very, very sad moment, and perhaps more so for me, because Jack and I were particular chums, you know. But there we are. That was that. And Jack, he was an only child, so I wrote to his parents, and but I couldn't tell him anything. But there we are. But that must have been an awful shock for them, particularly not knowing what had happened. At that time, the Barracudas, they never had a very good reputation, as I think you've gathered. Various things kept falling off them. I was never too well aware of this, but they used to say that the rivets used to pop when you'd been doing a lot of dive bombing, and the metal skin on the fuselage would show signs of wrinkling. Obviously there was some, whether it was what we now call metal fatigue, I don't know, but as a young pilot, you just flew the aeroplane. If it was serviceable, you didn't really ask too many questions. But what they did do was, and of course, from the point of view of morale, I suppose it was all dumbed down a bit. But what they did do, they withdrew the aircraft perhaps three at a time, and they were strengthened. They put extra strengthening in the ribs and around the tail units, and obviously declared them safe, which, as far as I was concerned, they were. But there were obviously problems, and whether this was what caused poor old Jack's demise, we don't know. Maybe the wing locking fell off or something, but we don't know. But we continued flying the Barracudas. There was a rumour that we would ditch them and would transfer to fly Grumman Avengers, big American torpedo bombers. But my understanding was no, because A, there weren't enough of them to spare. We'd got Avenger squadrons, but they probably needed all the spares. And I was never sure whether our ship would have been capable of taking them, because they were bigger and heavier aeroplanes, and perhaps Vengeance couldn't cope. But I'm not an expert, I couldn't tell you that.
Was the pilot ever found, the other pilot, the
commander? No, nobody was ever found, no. So we lost four people in one day, or in, you know, one day and one night. And that's it, but we just carried on. While we were there in Malta, I should add that, we'd obviously slipped one or two crews for reasons I don't know, but we did pick up three more fully trained crews while we were in Malta. They'd come out to us and joined the squadron, and they did in fact stay with us for the rest of the time.
Did you sail on from Malta in May then, after VE Day, or was it longer?
I think it was about the 20th of May when we finally left Malta. Again, nobody tells you where you're going, but it was obvious from where the sun was that we were going east up the Mediterranean. We stopped off at Alexandria for, I don't know, 48 hours. We did have a run ashore, I do remember that. And I couldn't believe that Alexandria was like a land of plenty. I mean, there was a wonderful cake shop called Pastrudis, where you could get the most gorgeous cream cakes and things, wonderful confections. There was no sign of a war. There was the Alexandria Sporting Club, which was a very posh and toffee-nosed sort of place, but we were allowed in there as officers. We went and spent time there, and they had a race course. There was a race course there. I used to think I knew a bit about horse racing, but I couldn't fathom this lot out because, I mean, you've never seen jockeys pulling horses back so much. Anyway, I think we managed to lose a few pounds, but we quickly gave that up. But it was a pleasant couple of days break. Then came a very sad period, because we sailed away from there. I can't remember how many ships we'd got, whether we'd still got the other two with us. I suspect we must have done. And off we went down the Red Sea, down the Suez Canal, which was quite an experience, of course, and down the Red Sea. And the temperature then, because by then, end of May, beginning of June, presumably, it really, really was hot. And I think I've mentioned before that when you're in a metal-decked aircraft carrier, the conditions below are like a huge... I mean, we didn't have a lot of air conditioning in those days. So it was pretty, pretty awful. A lot of people got prickly heat. Life wasn't very good. I was quite seriously ill, although I didn't realise it. I'd got allowed myself to get dehydrated. I must have been hallucinating because I'd taken to my bed and somebody sort of found me there and called the doc, and I think he made me drink gallons of water, and I eventually came round. But it was I could have done myself a bit of a mischief there, but it was awful. And a sad story: we had a ship's officer, I can't remember his name, but he was always called Snowdrop, because he was a very pale-faced, pale-skinned sort of character, a lovely chap. His job was to, he was in charge of all the deck landing operating gear, the barriers and the arrestor wires, and he was a very good engineer, lieutenant engineer. Now he had to do a stint in the engine room. Well, they all did, but these poor chaps working in the engine room, they could only work half an hour at a time because of the heat, and this poor chap died, just passed out from the heat. And of course he had to be buried at sea very quickly. I think within 24 hours he was buried at sea, and the funeral takes place on the quarter deck of the ship, which is just below the flight deck at the rear end of the ship, and our cabin, when I say ours, I'll come to that in a minute, was right underneath the quarter deck. So I can remember, with just a towel wrapped round me, coming out of my cabin door to go and get a shower, when they were carrying poor old Snowdrop wrapped in a shroud up to the quarter deck. So what did I do? I couldn't think what to do. I mean, you're standing there with a towel round, so I just stood to attention and had to let him go on his way. poor old Snowdrop. But it was when you're just 20 years old and you see something like that, it sort of sticks in the mind a bit, doesn't it? So
those conditions of heat as well.
It was virtually impossible. What they did, and particularly when we were in the Pacific, we were issued with camp beds that sort of dismantled. And we were allowed to sleep on the quarter deck, or even if we weren't operating, we could take our camp beds up onto the flight deck. Well, at least there was some air up there. But it was life was I didn't enjoy it.
Was it a long passage through that? Into because I take it you would have been going into the Indian Ocean, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we went down the Red Sea. We didn't stop at Aden, I don't think. No, I don't think we stopped anywhere until we got to Ceylon, which we now call Sri Lanka, of course. But it was Ceylon as far as we were concerned. And in a way, it was a huge relief. We were flown off ashore again. Again, we didn't know how long we were going to be there. We didn't know what the ship was going to be doing, but we flew off, and I can remember we flew off in the morning. May have been, again, an accelerated takeoff, but as I've explained before, we took the maintenance ratings with us, and we flew in formation, and we flew to Trincomalee, which is the naval base on the northeast corner of Ceylon, China Bay and Trincomalee, and it was quite a famous base. I can remember, as we circled round and broke formation to land, looking at the runway that we were going to land on, because it had been the scene in earlier on, a few months, about a year or so earlier, when the top naval fighter pilot, a chap called Dickie Cork, had met his end on this selfsame runway. It was it's not part of the story here, but he'd actually he'd taken off one of the big carriers, and he was landing early in the morning, before the airfield was officially open, and there was another Corsair, he was in a Corsair, and there was another Corsair taking off, and for reasons nobody quite understands, they were going in opposite directions. So there was a huge collision in the middle of the runway, and sadly they were both killed, and Dickie Cork was, he'd flown in the Navy, but with the RAF in the Battle of Britain. In fact, he flew as Douglas Bader's wingman for a period, and he'd got a whole string of victories. He was a top fighter pilot. Gone. And I was just saying that as we circled to land, I looked at this runway and it all suddenly came into my mind. But there we are. We landed there at Trincomalee early in the morning. We went into the wardroom. We had a very nice breakfast. And then Cedric said, well, don't unpack because we're moving. So we said, well, where are we going now? So he said, well, we're going to a place called Katakaranda, which was a big naval airfield, but completely on the other side of the island. It's the southwest side of Ceylon, just below Colombo, about 60 miles south of Colombo. And the extraordinary thing was that in Trincomalee, it's a hot, dry, arid, desert climate, quite pleasant. Rather like North Africa, that sort of climate. You cross to the other side and it's completely the opposite. It's humid, it's wet, and it's hot, and it's got snakes. And it really is horrible. I mean, I just couldn't stand that sort of climate, but that was it. On the way over, and this, looking back on it, it's ridiculous. I mean, all we were told was follow the lead. Cedric knew where he was going. He had an observer and he had the maps. All we knew was we were going to a place called Katakaranda, which meant nothing to us. So all I had to do was follow the leader. Not just me, but nearly everybody. On the way over, we went into the most terrible, shocking monsoon type weather. It was, I don't think I've ever flown in anything like it. The aircraft were bouncing about. How we kept in formation, it got dark. We were it was like flying into the depths of you know where. But absolutely terrifying, because I thought, well, if I lose touch, where am I going? I didn't know where I was going, or what the place looked like. So for some, by some miracle, we did stay together. Fortunately, as we came across to the coast, the weather broke and it was quite sunny when we actually landed at Katakaranda. But that was a pretty horrific sort of flight. And I often look back on it and I think, well, you know, this should never happen. You shouldn't. Nobody should take off without proper maps and knowing where they were going and where would you put down if you had problems. But
it seems almost against all your training that you'd had before as well, didn't it?
Yeah, but you see, once you joined a squadron, I mean, basically your job is just to follow the leader and do what go. But maybe Richard, it was my fault. Perhaps I was too idle to actually check up on these things. But you know, when I had an observer flying with me, well, of course, I didn't bother. I mean, it's up to him to work out where we're going. But on a situation like this, when you know, I didn't have any observer, I just the maintenance rating, and I felt sorry for them because of the weather we went through. They must have been, oh dear. It couldn't have been much fun. Anyway, there we were. We arrive at Katakaranda, I don't know where what sort of time of the year we must have been, about June then, June, July, I suppose. And we were going to be there. We didn't know. Nobody tells you anything, but it turned out we were there for again. Probably a month, more, yeah, for certainly longer than we anticipated. And really, nobody quite knew why we'd stopped there. I mean, we were fully trained. But what we did do while we were there, we didn't do an awful lot of flying, but what we did do, we learnt to use this rocket-assisted takeoff, RATOG, for the simple reason that Barracudas and Merlin engines lose a lot of efficiency in hot, humid climate, that the engine power is reduced because of the pressures, temperatures and pressures. I'm not a scientist, so I can't explain it, but it meant that if you were going to try and take off a ship with a reasonable load of weapons, you needed more power than the engine could provide. If you got a fairly short takeoff run, if you were right at the back, you had enough run. But it meant that you needed to have rocket-assisted takeoff if you were doing a free takeoff with a big load. And all this, they came along. I don't know whether I've told you this before, when they sort of bored little holes in the side of the aeroplane that they put on the side of the aeroplane things that looked like the undercarriage of a baby's pram, is the only way I can describe it, one on each side, and onto that they strapped or fixed about a 3 foot long concrete tube, or it seemed to me like a, which was the rocket. I don't know if it was made of concrete or asbestos or what, but it was a fairly hefty lump of stuff that was one on each side, and they were slightly angled out because they'd first tried them on swordfish, and they'd put them sort of square on to the, so that they were parallel to the side of the swordfish. Now, a swordfish is made of fabric, and they couldn't quite understand why they were sort of burning the fabric off the swordfish. So some bright spark said, well, all we've got to do is angle them out a bit so that the tail of the rockets is sticking out a bit. So that's what we had. And all that happened was you just open the throttle and take off in the normal way, and you get the tail up, and once you've got the tail up, you press a button, these two rockets fire, and they only will last for about 5 seconds, but in that time it lifts you sort of vertically off the ground, and by the time the rockets have expended themselves, you've got enough flying speed and away you go. This is the theory. And then what do you do? Well, you fly around until you make sure you haven't got any enemy ships underneath you. Oh, sorry, not enemy ships, friendly ships. You make sure you've got nothing underneath you, and you pull these little bits of wire like cheese wire, like with toggles on the end. And they withdrew split pins, and the whole contraption fell off into the sea. That was the theory. Now, things didn't always work out. Very often you took off, never happened to me, but very often you took off and the rockets fired perfectly well, and you pulled your little bits of wire, but they wouldn't fall off. Now, you can't fly far with great lumps of rocket stuff stuck onto your aeroplane when you're loaded up with bombs and rockets and things, so you couldn't ditch these things, so you had to come back with your tail between your legs, and you couldn't land with all this clobber on, so, and you couldn't get rid of the rockets, so you had to ditch your weapons, jettison the weapons, and then land on. So it was complete a bit of a waste of effort, wasn't it? I mean, the other thing that could happen, and did happen to a friend of mine, not in my squadron, I would add, one rocket would fire and the other one wouldn't, which meant you did a sort of cartwheel to the right or to the left, and that meant you usually ended up with a bit of a swim that you didn't really want, and this, a chum of mine, it did happen to him in a swordfish.